You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Joseph Badaracco. Joseph is the John Shadd Professor of Business Ethics at Harvard Business School. He is the author of several books, including The Good Struggle, Defining Moments, and Leading Quietly. He has a new book. It's called Step Back, How to Bring the Art of Reflection into Your Busy Life. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So we're during this sort of shelter in place global pandemic. We start the podcast with a check-in. I'm in my home in the northwest side of Chicago. Where are you?
I'm in Rhode Island. Narragansett, Rhode Island.
All right. Everything's safe and healthy, reasonably so there?
Well, my family's all doing fine. I would wish I would see a little more face covering when I was out and about. I mean, I saw a bunch of young guys playing basketball today. They were having a great time. Maybe there's no problem, but they're going to go home and see parents and you know, the rest of the story.
It is such a strange social experiment, because certainly I was so proud of my city and state at the beginning, and then everyone just took their foot off, and now it's a mixed bag. You'll have, you know, my neighborhood, relatively speaking, people are wearing masks, but, you know, I just drive a little bit and then no one has them on.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's, and I know this is a challenging time in which to publish a book, but I love the way you actually open this book with the words of a founder and CEO of a very successful venture capital firm. And it's this advice that he gives to entrepreneurs when his firm invests in their companies. Can you recount his words?
Sure. He says, if I ever come into your office and find you with your feet up on your desk, looking out the window, I'm going to double your salary.
Yeah, that's a zag. Certainly you wouldn't think that would be coming from a venture capital firm.
Yeah. Well, it's a humorous quote when you first hear it. But he's saying that, look, it's important to step back, especially if you're running a startup business, because you're always putting out fire. So it's important. He's saying it's really hard to do. That's why I'm going to double your salary if I actually see you doing it. But he's also saying you don't have to go off on a retreat or a mountain or some corporate training program. You can take moments of time and reflect and make progress. And that's basically, as you know, the theme of the book.
Yeah, and you write in the book, quote, busy, successful men and women do reflect, but they practice the art of reflection in the cracks and crevices of their everyday lives, end quote. And you actually have a term for this, which is mosaic reflection, right?
That's right. You know, what I I started the project because, like a lot of other people, I advise folks to reflect. Mm-hmm. And but that advice is usually not accompanied by an explanation of what reflection is.
Right.
Or if you're busy, how you find time to do it. So I thought I would simply find out empirically what busy people did, if anything, to reflect. And I had no strong expectations. I may have had a weak expectation that people would say they didn't do it. And in fact, a lot of people, when we started the interview, would sort of apologize and say, I'm really not the right person because I don't spend much time reflecting. I'm just too busy. We would talk a little bit and kind of broaden the definition of reflection, move away from this going up to the mountain approach. And they would realize, in about half the cases, I interviewed them twice. They had like a 2-week period in between to think a little bit more, that there were lots of little bits of reflection that they had built into their schedule, and they found it valuable. They did it most of the time, and it was reflection. But each person had their own pattern of little bits, and that's why I called it mosaic reflection.
Yeah, we're so built to think that these amazing inventions and innovations come out of these like singular sparks. And I've worked in improvisational theater for over 30 years. And so I know from firsthand that that's not the case, that it comes from a great deal of practice and different modes of reflection. And you say in the book that the art of reflection is like the other arts. To do it well, you have to practice. And I don't think a lot of people do.
Well, not a lot of people do it consciously.
Right.
And one of the things I did in the book was, in addition to interviewing the 100 people and finding out what they did, is I read a number of the classics of reflection, mm-hmm. and tried to find out what it really was if you look at it over centuries. And I think if you only have a small amount of time to reflect, or even if you have a lot of time, you ought to spend the time well. Mm-hmm. And so the book tries to say, this is what reflection is from this classic enduring perspective. And then it says, this is how these people I interviewed actually found time to do it in their busy lives.
I remember I've told the story a couple times on here, but I did a TEDx talk and I scripted it and I'm not good at, I was never an actor. So I couldn't memorize the script, and I actually went up on my lines and I was able to improvise because I can do that. And I was talking to Adam Grant about this,
yeah.
and he was saying to me, he's like, just, you know, your stories, take your time to daydream with your stories, walk around with them physically.
Yeah.
So I would go on walks and kind of tell my story.
Yeah.
And then I came back to the basement and I just sort of recorded myself doing it. And then when I delivered the second one, it went great. And you talk about that in the book, that actually this idea of physical movement and daydreaming, these are all part and parcel of reflecting.
That's right. For certain people.
Yeah.
What was surprising to me about this mosaic pattern was how it differed across almost all 100 people. Mm-hmm. And folks had really worked out their own distinctive approach, where, when, what they thought about.
You also have a bunch of design principles inside here. And one of them that I really liked was aim for good enough, which may not seem like, you know, that would show up in certain kinds of business books. But talk about what you mean when you say aim for good enough.
Well, I think there is one fairly common view of reflection, which is every night for half an hour before you go to bed, or every morning you get up half an hour earlier and do something regular and systematic, and maybe you write it down. And I did interview a handful of people out of the 100 who followed that approach. But a lot of people said, I could never do it, just in terms of my character. That's not possible for me. Others might have liked to do it, but they didn't have the time. But a number of people said, look, what I do is try to reflect fairly often, fairly well. And I can make progress on issues that concern me, that I really want to think through, that I care about. I don't have to do it on this regular, systematic basis. And, you know, there was a famous book written, I think, in the 1940s by a child psychologist named Winnicott, who talked about the good enough mother. Mm-hmm. This became the good enough parent. And the idea is, there's an old saying that the better or the best is the enemy of the good. And if you feel defeated because you can't do something perfectly and you just give up, that's a mistake. At least with things that are important to do, even if you don't do them very well, do them pretty well. Declare victory. That's the theme of that chapter.
And you also refer in here to the idea of the cult of productivity. And that even goes back to the opening statement by that CEO, which is the idea of always on, of always looking busy. I mean, I see that in business all the time, and it belies what actually leads us to our successful peak performances.
That's correct.
They need rest, right?
That's right. But it's very satisfying just to knock one thing after another off. It's a way sometimes to avoid thinking about other things. And by the way, you know, we do want smart people who are paid a lot of money working really hard. Mm-hmm. So on the whole, there's nothing wrong with this cult of productivity, but if it becomes a lifestyle rather than a work practice, then you get into problems and it does become an obstacle to reflection.
Yeah, well, I think you can look to the other, you know, you can look to the arts, you can look to sports, you can look to the peak performers require rest, and they require reflection in terms of as part of their mode. They discovered this with the basketball players, right? I mean, especially now, it's amazing. The knee problems of the past have been kind of solved by them, you know, stretching out, doing yoga, resting and not playing so much.
Yeah.
And so they sort of figured that out as we understand our bodies, and that has to affect our mind, because there's like neurological aspects to why this is going on too, right?
Yeah, and you may have been referring to this. There was also a study a couple of years ago that I think it was with a Stanford basketball team. If they got the players to sleep an extra hour at night, their free throw completion percentage went up. Three shots went up. They could, in other words, they could quantify the results of this. And what's interesting is some of the people I talked to were spectacularly successful, you know, by all the resume measures. So they were CEOs of big companies. And they were conscious of what we're talking about now, the need to take breaks. One guy said that when he had a serious problem, he discussed it with the senior team, it was time to make a decision, he didn't know what to do, he would close his office door and put on some of his favorite Broadway musicals. He wanted something that would just sort of take over his mind and his spirit. And then he'd come back to it. And sometimes he'd make progress. Sometimes he had to sleep on it. But he knew he had to pause. And that's what a lot of the people I interviewed were finding ways to do. You know, just to pause briefly, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, step back, and then see what you come up with.
Back when I would record this podcast at WGN Studios, it's about, I don't know, a 10 to 15 minute drive from Second City to downtown. I started actually leaving a half hour earlier than I needed to, just so I had some like casual time. And I'd also mark up my calendar that I get back a little later, just in case I wanted that time just to walk around and think. And you interviewed someone who did something similar to that.
Exactly. She was running a staff of maybe 1,500 people. And of course, the standard approach would be for them to come to her office. She would, every couple days or so, say, I'll come to your office. And then she put aside a little extra time to walk there slowly. And mm-hmm. she said it wasn't management by walking around. In other words, observing and encouraging people. She just wanted a little break. And another guy, actually, who was a CFO, head full of numbers, would take a walk from his office to the CEO's office by an indirect route when the weather was decent, just an extra 5 or 10 minutes. But I really have to emphasize that there You can take the time, and that's valuable, but it's really important to use the time well. And that's where I tried to emphasize these three enduring fundamental approaches to reflection that I call downshifting, pondering, and measuring up. And so you got to do two things. You got to find the time, notice the time, but then you got to use it well.
Last week, we interviewed one of your Harvard colleagues, Francis Frey, and we've been doing, Second City has done some improv work in the class that she and Francesca Gino are teaching. And she said to me, the thing that she took out of the improvisational exercises that hit her the most was the way you had to sort of separate analysis from creativity, and that when you are being creative, you cannot be in self-judgment. And I thought about that when you write in the book, quote, when you downshift or contemplate, you are consciously trying to suspend your default mental habits of analytical thinking, cost-benefit analysis, and planning next steps. I think we're kind of talking about the same thing there.
We exactly are. And that's just a universal habit and practice. And again, it's made us wealthy. It makes people productive, so forth. But too much of it is a real problem. And it's an obstacle to seeing what's going on around you, to getting a sense of what's going on inside yourself, to getting a sense of what might be coming down the road ahead of you. So that's why you've got to find one fundamental approach to reflection is this downshifting. It's finding little tactics to turn that mental engine down a little bit. You can never turn it off, but just turn it down some fewer RPMs.
Yeah. And I think it gets harder both as you get older and you have success. So I think you were talking to people who mostly, I think, are in fairly successful positions.
That's right.
And you say in the book, quote, it takes a focused effort in order to unfocus. That's that demographic, because they're just so laser and they've got it and they know their patterns. And so to upset that, to stop that, really does take serious effort.
Well, and it feels good to do it. And by the way, I also emphasize that a lot of people don't have or don't think they have enough time to reflect because they have serious responsibilities and they want to meet them. Yeah. So it's not like they're spending too much time on daytime TV or video games between home and work, the rest of life. They're trying to get done what they really believe is important to get done, and other people are relying on them. And that's also great, but it's an obstacle.
Yeah. There was another note I put down here in this chapter where you talk about the problem about rumination, and you say, quote, rumination is like a piece of music you can't get out of your head. That's a bad habit too. That's another kind of spinning.
Yeah, and that's not really reflection, at least after the first couple of rotations. And if you're just not making progress, distract yourself, you know, do something.
Yeah.
Have a drink, whatever works, you know.
Mm-hmm. You say in the book, quote, pondering relies on what the poet John Keats called negative capability. That is the skill of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. That's beautiful. And actually, I should say this, you weave throughout the book some of these great thinkers and poets and as part of the story of where we are and why this is important. Because again, I think it seems so simple that we don't give it the time we need to understand all that is at play.
That's right. And don't pay, I think, enough attention to doing it better or trying to do it right. And pondering is basically a way of, if you've got a problem or an issue, trying to make sure you're looking at it from a variety of different perspectives, including some perspectives that may not be your natural way of thinking about things, that may not reflect your position in society but reflect others, that may not reflect sort of thoughts or concerns that are at the margin of your mind, because what you're trying to do is crack the case. Here's a problem. Mm-hmm. People need an answer. The meeting's just about over. You do this, you do that. And then that's fine with a lot of routine stuff. You got to do that. But sometimes something tells you, wait a minute, this is more complicated. And then you have to try somewhat systematically to say, I'll put aside what I think is the right answer, the first thing that occurred to me, and look at it from a variety of different perspectives. See what you come up with.
One of the texts you return to sort of time and again in the book is Montaigne's Essays.
Yes.
Which I didn't realize that the 16th century meaning of essays is tests and traits.
Trials, yes, attempts, things like that. Like, yes.
So talk to us about that inspiration.
Well, this is an example of sort of certainly a mosaic. He was unique. If you read some of his essays, from sentence to sentence, things jump around. So there's a unique and personalized pattern of his thinking. He was completely comfortable with letting his mind wander, meander. He loved finding different perspectives on things. He was also one of the first people in history, apparently, to really be self-conscious about himself, his character, his beliefs, his feelings, and he wrote it all down. And it's this really engaging mess because if you want to read through any essay for a big point and four pieces of evidence, you won't find it. But if you like his style, you will follow him down all these different paths and think differently, not just about him, but about yourself. And it really is a way of kind of stepping back and looking at things very differently. And it's funny, Montaigne did this in a way that so many people, when they read his essays, they sort of find themselves in it. And so I've been looking at his essays off and on for decades now. I don't know how I first came across them, but they are a marvel of reflection.
I had to respond to a client request. This was yesterday, where they wanted to have us do some training around unconscious bias, but they wanted to confirm that we can both get everyone to understand their unconscious bias and then never behave badly again. Nick Epley is a scholar at the University of Chicago that we work closely with, who does a lot of work in this area of how we the many ways in which we misperceive ourselves and others. And you say in the book, quote, seeing ourselves as we are is the most challenging aspect of measuring up. That kind of reflection is very, very hard.
Yes, a psychologist, his name doesn't come back to me, a social scientist at the University of Virginia, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Strangers to Ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think I cited in there. His view is that if you can get them to speak honestly, your friends often have a much better sense of who you are and what your values are than you do. That's an intriguing idea to play with.
Yeah. Well, then you have to get people to tell you the truth, which I think they're often reluctant to.
That's right. Maybe between the lines sometimes.
Yeah, maybe
you can detect a little bit.
But this idea of your actions and your identities, I think you say they're braided together, and in fact they are. So I mean, you can have all the fantastic moral ideas, but if you are not acting in that way, if you are not showing up, you know, on your stage with that, then that's a problem.
Yes. Two of the three people that I really learned a lot from, classic writers on reflection, were Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor, who was also a general fighting against the invading German tribes for the last 10 years of his life, and Ignatius Loyola, who was a soldier before he was wounded and started the Jesuits. And they believed firmly in discipline, and part of that discipline was consistency between what they believed, what they wanted to do, and what they actually did. Mm-hmm. If anything, they could be a little too hard on themselves, particularly in the case of Ignatius of Loyola. But the idea was that you can easily trick yourself or seduce yourself with good thoughts, elevated thoughts, idealistic ambitions. And you have to hold yourself accountable, looking at what you're actually doing. And that's the thrust of the chapter on measuring up. Mm-hmm. You've got standards you want to meet for yourself. other people expect you to meet certain standards. So how are you doing? You need to step back and try to assess that.
Yeah, you also talk in the book about literally talking to yourself. Right? And this that may sound, you know, strange to someone at first, but not when they reflect on the many different ways that we do talk back to ourselves, either in our religious traditions, or certainly in some of our artistic traditions, too.
Yes. You know, it goes all the way back to Socrates and dialogue, yeah, which is such an important part of our tradition. But these were a couple people who said that they, in one case, he said he held debates in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And others just would walk around and talk and say, well, yes, I think I'm going to do that, but what's the problem with that? And you don't want to do this, you know, on a bus or a subway.
Right. But,
again, it's stepping back before you decide or do something. And then it's trying to look at it from a variety of perspectives, in this case, generated in your own brain. But if it works for you, if you really have a sense it works for you, do it. Do it as often as you can.
I like to, in this chapter, how, because you talk about stepping back, and then you also talk about stepping back further. And yeah, you quote Annie Dillard, who I love, and I have found so much wisdom in her writing, that she wrote, quote, how we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives.
Yes. That's in the book, where I also quote another executive who talks about stepping back further means spending more time, not just 5 or 10 minutes, but every week, every couple weeks, half an hour, put aside some time, and then either contemplate or ponder or think about measuring up in some real depth. And this executive put it in terms of stepping back to think about what he called the architecture of his life. Mm. You know, what he was trying to do and how the different pieces were coming together or weren't coming together. And that's not something you can do 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there. So while it's easy to be critical of the go to the mountain, take a retreat approach, which people can't do, that approach does recognize something, that you really do need to take more time with some issues or just periodically and see what you can learn and see what comes up. You can't do everything mosaic style.
So through the research and writing of this book, did you come out the other end with any new or different ideas or practices for yourself?
Yes. You mentioned the woman who walked slowly. I've sort of generalized that. And a couple times a day, I will try for a couple minutes to do whatever I'm doing a little more slowly.
Oh, interesting.
That's kind of a release and kind of flexibility. Mm-hmm. I also do try to spend a little bit more time looking out windows. Mm-hmm. And especially if you can see some, nature or something like that, I find that attractive. I think the only other thing I think I became aware of having written the book were the other brief moments of reflection that I was doing already.
Right.
So like talking with my wife about things. And, you know, you can talk about the dumb show, detective show you watched the night before. Or you can try to shift the conversation to something of more significance. And I'd like to try to do that sometimes.
You know?
Yeah. Nothing against dumb detective shows.
No. Everything has its purpose. All right. Yeah. The way we end the podcast is we ask our guest for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. They actually don't get that far by saying yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten the idea. So I'm wondering if you have a story from life or work where maybe you were going to say no, but instead you said yes and.
Well, when my wife and I had been married for about 2 years, I had 3 kids from my first marriage. Mm-hmm. They were still fairly young. And the question was, should we have a child, and specifically, should we adopt the child?
Mm.
And, you know, you could imagine all the different things that you would consider doing that, that go into a decision like that. But there was a moment when we both sort of together said yes. And of course it was at least as I interpret this, an immense and.
Yeah.
Because There were already three.
That's a lot.
And even though the three were going back and forth with their mother, they were with us a lot. And this was a big and. And it's turned out to be a great and.
I love it. The book is called Step Back, How to Bring the Art of Reflection into Your Busy Life. Joseph Badaracco, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
Getting the S.A.N. is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feel young.
Survive from adulthood. No one survives.